Leon believed that the flying visit to Percy's camp down in the Rift Valley and the wild buffalo hunt in the Thorn signalled the commencement of the safari in earnest. He thought that the Graf was at last ready to head out into the blue. His assumption was incorrect. The second morning after their return from Percy's camp and the nocturnal landing at the polo ground, Graf Otto sat at the head of the breakfast table at Tundala camp with a dozen envelopes stacked in front of him. Every one was a response to the official letters from the German Foreign Office in Berlin that Max Rosenthal had distributed to all the dignitaries of British East Africa. Graf Otto translated excerpts from each missive to Eva, who was sitting opposite him, nibbling daintily on slices of fruit. It seemed that all of Nairobi society was agog to have in their midst a man like Graf Otto von Mirbach. Like any other frontier town, Nairobi needed little excuse for a party, and he was the best excuse they had been presented with since the opening of the Mutaiga Country Club 3 years previously. Every letter contained an invitation. The governor of the colony was hosting a special dinner at Government House in his honour. Lord Delamere was holding a formal ball at his new Norfolk hotel to welcome him and Fräulein von Velberg to the territory. The committee of the Mutaiga Country Club had voted Graf Otto an honorary member, and, not to be outdone by Delamere, were also throwing a ball to initiate him into club membership. The officer commanding His Britannic Majesty's Armed Forces in East Africa, Brigadier General Penrod Ballantyne's invitation was to a banquet at the regimental mess. Lord Charlie Warboys had invited the couple to a 4-day pig-sticking party on his 50,000-acre estate on the edge of the Rift Valley. The Nairobi Polo Club had voted Graf Otto full membership and asked him to play on their first team in a challenge match against the King's African Rifles on the first Saturday of the coming month. Graf Otto was delighted by the furore he had stirred up. Listening to him discuss each invitation with Eva, Leon realized that their departure from Nairobi had receded to some time in the remote future. Graf Otto accepted every one of the invitations and in return issued his own to spectacular dinners, banquets and balls that he would host at the Norfolk, the Mutaiga, or out at Tandala Camp. Leon now understood why he had sent out such enormous supplies of food and drink on the SS Silbervogel. However, the Graf's masterstroke of hospitality, which warmed every heart in the colony and earned him the instant reputation of being a cracking good fellow, was his open day. He issued a public invitation to a picnic on the polo ground. At this gathering, selected guests, such as the Governor, Delamere, Warboys, and Brigadier General Ballantyne, would be given a flight over the town in one of his aeroplanes. Then Eva exerted her influence and persuaded him to extend the invitation to every boy and girl between the ages of 6 and 12. They were all to be given a flight. The entire colony went into raptures. The ladies were determined to turn the open day into an African equivalent of Ascot. From a simple picnic, it snowballed into an almost royal occasion. Lord Warboys donated 3 prime young oxen to be roasted on spits over beds of coals. Every member of the Women's Institute got busy with her oven, turning out cakes and pies. Lord Delamere took over the supply of beer. He sent an urgent rate cable to the brewery at Mombasa and received an assurance that a large quantity would be on its way within days. Word of the invitation went out into the hinterland, and settler families on the remote farms loaded their wagons in preparation for the trek to Nairobi. There were only 4 dressmakers in town, and their services were immediately booked out. The open-air barbers on Main Street were busy clipping beards and trimming hair. The boys' school and the girls' convent declared a holiday, and rumour flew through the classrooms that every child who made a flight would be presented by Graf Otto with a commemoration gift in the form of a perfect scale model of the butterfly. Leon was sucked into all of this feverish activity. Graf Otto decided he needed a second pilot to deal with the hordes of eager children who would be queuing for a flight. He would pilot the senior guests, but he was not enthusiastic about filling his cockpit with their offspring. As he remarked to Eva in Leon's hearing, he preferred children in their sweet spirit rather than in their clamorous, noisome flesh.
"Courtney, I promised I would teach you to fly."
Leon was taken by surprise. This was the first time Graf Otto had mentioned the flight instruction since the buffalo hunt, and he had thought the promise conveniently forgotten. "So, we go to the airfield immediately. Courtney, today you learn to fly." Leon sat beside Graf Otto in the cockpit of the Bumblebee and listened intently as he described the functions and operation of each dial and instrument, the taps and switches, the levers and controls. Despite their complexity, Leon already had a working knowledge of the flight deck layout acquired on the monkey-see-monkey-do principle. When Graf Otto listened as Leon repeated everything he had just learned, he chuckled and nodded. "Ah, ah, I've been watching me when I fly. Ah, quick, Courtney, this is good." Leon had not expected he would make a good instructor, and was pleasantly surprised by the Graf's attention to detail and his patience. They began on engine start-up and shut-down, then moved on quickly to ground taxiing, crosswind, downwind, and interwind. Leon started to feel the controls and the big machine's response to them, like the reins and stirrups of a horse. Nevertheless, he was surprised when Graf Otto tossed him a leather flying helmet. "Put it on!" They had taxied to the far end of the polo ground, and he shouted above the engine roar, "Nose to wind!" Leon put on full starboard rudder and gunned the two port engines. Already he had assimilated the use of opposing thrust to manoeuvre the machine. The Bumblebee came around handily and put her nose into the wind.
"You want to fly? So, fly!"
Graf Otto shouted into his ear. Leon gave him a horrified, disbelieving look. It was too soon. He wasn't ready yet. He needed a little more time.
"Gott in Himmel!" Graf Otto bellowed. "Why are you waiting? Fly her!"
Leon took a long, slow breath and reached for the bank of throttles. He opened them gradually, listening for the beat of the separate engines to synchronize. Like an old lady running for a bus, the Bumblebee broke into a trot, then a canter, and finally a sprint. Leon felt the joystick come alive in his hands. He felt the lightness of impending flight in his fingertips, in his feet on the rudder bars, and in his spirit. It was a feeling of absolute power and control. His heart began to sing in the rush of the wind. The nose veered off line, and he met it with a touch of rudder and brought it back. He felt the Bumblebee bounce lightly under him. "She wants to fly," he thought. "We both want to fly." Beside him, Graf Otto made a small gesture, and Leon understood what it meant. The joystick was trembling in his fingers, and he pressed it gently forward. Behind him, the massive tailplane lifted clear of the grassy surface, and the Bumblebee reacted gratefully to the decrease in drag. He felt her quicken in his hands, and as Graf Otto made the next signal, he was already easing the joystick back. Once, twice, the wheels bounced, and then she was flying. He lifted the nose and settled it on the horizon ahead in the attitude of climb. They went up and up. He shot a glance over the side of the cockpit and saw the earth falling away below. He was flying. His hands were the only ones on the stick. His feet alone were on the rudder bars. He was really flying. He soared on upwards joyfully. Beside him, Graf Otto nodded approvingly, then gave him the signal to level out of the climb, to bank left and bank right. Stick and rudder together, Leon put the Bumblebee over, and she responded docilely. Graf Otto nodded again and raised his voice so that Leon could catch the words.
"Some are born with the wind in our hair and the starlight in our eyes. I think you may be one of us, Courtney."
Under his instructions, Leon circled wide, then lined up on the runway. He had not yet learned how to slow the machine and at the same time lose height. He should have held the nose up and let her bleed off speed, sinking under her own weight. Instead, he pushed the nose down and dived towards the field, coming in much too fast. The Bumblebee was still flying when she hit the ground with a crash and ballooned up off the grassy strip. He was forced to open the throttles wide and go around again. Beside him, Graf Otto laughed.
"Ha! You still have much to learn, Courtney. Try again!"
On the next approach, he did better. With her vast wing area, the Bumblebee had a low stall speed. He came in over the fence of the polo ground at 30 feet above the ground, with 40 knots of airspeed indicated. He held her nose up and let her sink to the earth. She touched down with a jolt that clashed his teeth, but did not bounce, and Graf Otto laughed again.
"Ha! Good! Much better! Go around again!"
Leon was getting the feel of it quickly. Each of the next three landings was an improvement on the preceding effort, and the fourth was a perfect three-point touchdown, the main undercarriage and tail wheel kissing the ground in unison.
"Excellent!" Graf Otto shouted. "Taxi to the hangar!"
Leon felt heady with success. His first day of instruction had been a triumph, and he knew he could look forward to continued improvement over the days ahead. When he swung the bumblebee around in front of the hangar, he reached for the fuel cock to shut off the engines, but Graf Otto forestalled him.
"No, I am getting out, but you are not."
"I don't understand," Leon was puzzled. "What do you want me to do?"
"I promised to teach you how to fly, and I have done so. Now, go and fly, Courtney, or go and kill yourself. It is all the same to me."
Graf Otto von Mirbach scrambled over the side of the cockpit and disappeared, leaving Leon, after the grand total of 3 hours' tuition, facing his first solo flight. It took a deliberate effort of mind and body to force himself to reach forward and grip the throttle handle. His mind was in a spin. He had forgotten everything he had just learned. He began his takeoff run with the wind behind his tail. The bumblebee ran and ran, building up airspeed so gradually that he was only able to wrench her into the air seconds before she hit the boundary fence. He cleared it with 3 feet to spare, but at least he was flying. He glanced over his shoulder and saw Graf Otto standing in front of the hangar with his fists on his hips, his head thrown back and his whole body convulsed with laughter.
"A wonderful sense of humour you have, von Mirbach, deliberately wounding a couple of buffalo and sending up a complete novice to kill himself. Anything for a laugh."
But his anger was ephemeral and forgotten almost immediately. He was flying solo. The earth and the sky belonged to him alone. The sky was bright and clear except for a single silver cloud that seemed not much larger than his hand. He put the bumblebee into a climb and banked towards it. It seemed almost solid as the earth, and he flew close over the top. Then he turned and came back, and this time he touched the top of the silver billows with his wheels, as though he was landing upon them.
"Playing with clouds!" he exulted. "Is this how the angels and the gods pass their time?"
He dropped down through the cloud bank and was blinded for a few seconds in the silver mists, then burst out through them into the sunlight, laughing with the joy of it. Down and down he plummeted, and the great brown land rushed up to meet him. He levelled out, his wheels skimming the treetops, the wide expanse of the Athi plains opened ahead, and he dropped even lower. 30 feet above the earth, and at 100 miles an hour, he charged across the treeless wilderness. The game herd scattered in pandemonium under his wheels. He was so low that he had to lift his port wingtip to avoid collision with the outstretched neck of a galloping bull giraffe. He climbed again and turned towards the line of the Ngong Hills. From 2 miles out he picked out the thatched roofs of Tandala Camp. He flew over it so low that he could recognize the faces of the camp staff who stared up at him in amazement. There were Manyoro and Loikot. He leaned over the side of the cockpit and waved, and they danced and cavorted, waving back in wild exuberance. He looked for a white face among them, not just any white face, but that special one, and felt a throb of disappointment that she was not there. He turned back towards the airstrip and was skimming the tops of the Ngong Hills when he saw the horse. It was on the skyline directly ahead, the grey mare she always favoured. Then he saw her standing at its head. She wore a bright yellow blouse and a wide-brimmed straw hat. She looked up at the approaching aircraft but showed no animation.
"Of course, she doesn't know it's me. She thinks it's Graf Otto."
Leon smiled to himself and dropped towards her. He pushed back his goggles and leaned over the side of the cockpit. He was so close to her that he saw the moment she recognized him. She threw back her head and he saw the flash of her teeth as she laughed. She snatched off her hat and waved it as he thundered over her, so close that the mare pranced and tossed her head with alarm. He fancied he could even make out the colour of Ava's eyes. As he climbed away, he twisted in the seat to look back at her. She was still waving. He wanted her in the cockpit beside him. He wanted to be able to reach out and touch her. Then he remembered the signal pad in the locker beside him. Graf Otto had used a page of it to illustrate a point of instruction. A pencil was attached to it on a length of twine. He held the pad between his knees and scribbled quickly, keeping his other hand on the controls. "Fly away with me to Lonsonio Mountain, Badger." He ripped the page out and folded it into a tiny square. In the locker where he had found the pad, there was a ball of scarlet message ribbons, each 6 feet long. He pulled one out. One end was weighted with a lead slug, the size of a musket ball, and at the other there was a small buttoned pocket. He slipped the folded message into it and closed it, then turned the bumblebee back. She was still on the hilltop, but now she was mounted on the grey. She saw the bumblebee coming back and rose in the stirrups. He made a hasty calculation of height and speed, then dropped the signal ribbon over the side of the cockpit. It unrolled in the slipstream and fluttered down. Ava turned the mare and galloped after the falling scrap of scarlet. When he turned the machine in a tight circle back towards her, he saw her swing down from the saddle as she found the ribbon. She opened the pocket and pulled out his note, read it and waved both hands above her head, nodding vigorously. Her teeth flashed as she laughed.